Good evening and welcome behind the news for July 31, 2003. This is Doug Henwood and looking as we do most week at this time, weeks at this time at the world of economics and politics. And I will hold my usual comments on the economic news till the end of the show because our first guest sitting here in the studio has to get out as quickly as possible. So let's save my usual analyses for last. And I've got two segments scheduled for tonight. First, we'll speak with Ken Churl, who's a professor of political science at Hunter College, on the mayor's proposal for nonpartisan elections, which may sound good on the surface, but may look a little less good on closer inspection. And then at the bottom of the hour or so, we'll speak with Helen Rudy Brockman, who is a nurse and also a member of the Board of Physicians for a National Health Program, about schemes that are working through Congress to privatize Medicare under the guise of providing a prescription drug benefit. And then about quarter of we'll listen to my analysis of the economic situation. But now we're joined in the studio by Ken Churl, who teaches politics at Hunter and is an expert in many things. I think I've had you talking about city politics, CUNY politics, right. CUNY funding, but tonight it's nonpartisan elections. And the mayor has proposed, and also Giuliani also proposed about 4 or 5 years ago, having nonpartisan elections for the senior officials of New York City. And this sort of fits in with a lot of, you know, American ideology. Just choose the best guy for the job and party doesn't matter. Who cares about labels? And you think this is not such a great idea. Why not?
Well, there are lots of reasons. I mean, the first reason is the one that you've mentioned, which is that it moves the focus of politics away from issues and ideas and onto personalities. So the idea becomes, you know, find, you know, the candidate on a white horse, find the fearless leader, find the strong man who will give that person the power to do whatever that person thinks is right. Politics really, especially in a democracy, politics should surround issues and ideas. The voters should be deeply connected with the question of what government policy ought to be. Now, political parties have a history. In the case of the United States, the Republican Party goes back to before the Civil War. The Democratic Party goes back to Jefferson. And over those years, the parties have done things, and people have learned through one process or another what the parties traditionally have stood for, what groups of people in society the parties have benefited and have harmed, so that they can use their opinions and knowledge of the parties to evaluate the candidates as the candidates come along.
Now, the standard line is that party loyalty has eroded.
It has.
And for a lot of people, the parties, well, the Democratic Party in particular, doesn't stand for much of anything. Republican Party, you know, looks like a bunch of scary, xenophobic, religious fundamentalists willing to wage war on the rest of the world. But, you know, it's not easy to say what the Democrats stand for.
Well, Republicans have their divisions, too.
But fewer and fewer people are professing any kind of loyalty to party.
Right.
Why is that happening?
Two things have declined along with decline in party identification. There's been a declining interest in politics and a declining amount of information. Over the past two generations, the American people have become, in political terms, cognitively impoverished. They have fewer and fewer facts about politics, about government, about the party system. Certainly, if one were to look at say, roll call behavior in Congress, the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans statistically are sharper and more focused now than they have been at any time in recent history. And, in fact, those differences, which began to come into focus in the 70s, have become clearer and clearer. And over that time, as the Republicans have moved further and further to the right and the Democrats have moved less to the right, the number of people who are unable to articulate any difference between the parties has increased. There are lots of reasons for this, one of which has been the growth in reporting that focuses on personalities, that focuses on scandal, investigative reporting in many ways, has all contributed to a growing cynicism about politics, a loss of interest, loss of information, and as a result, an increased difficulty in being able to situate oneself. This is a proposal, though, that would take a bad situation and make it worse, because it would force people to focus on personalities rather than on issues. And what we really want is a politics that would get people to focus on issues.
But this first started circulating under Giuliani, who was a Republican, and Bloomberg, who is nominally a Republican, became right. one right. because he couldn't break into the Democratic fold, but right. is now a Republican. Can we read something into that?
Well, nonpartisan elections have generally been advanced by business and corporate interests as a kind of good government reform. One of the most interesting things about the argument that we now see in front of the Charter Revision Commission is that it's been about two issues. Turnout, whether or not turnout is depressed by nonpartisan elections, and second, whether minority representation in government is depressed by nonpartisan elections. No one has raised any questions about the content of public policy, about whether budgets are different, whether tax policies are different, whether the same people in society benefit from government policies under nonpartisan elections as they would under partisan elections. I was debating a member of the commission recently who pulled out, you know, the old canard that there's no Democratic or Republican way to clean the streets. And you know, I said, well, look, there may not be a Democratic or Republican way to clean the streets, but there are Democratic and Republican ways of paying for cleaning the streets, and there are often a Democratic and Republican ways of deciding whose streets get cleaned how often. And when you start doing things to restructure government in a way that provides more leverage for campaign contributors and concentrated wealth, you're likely to have a significant impact on the nature of public policy. And this is something that has been not discussed at all in this commission or any of the commissions that Giuliani appointed.
That's the voice of Ken Cherrill, a professor of politics at Hunter College. And this is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And you've said that nonpartisan elections actually probably increases upper class and business influence over government.
It may well.
How is that?
Well, since the parties have been around for 100 years, 200 years, they serve as a cue to the voters to evaluate political objects, such as candidates, as they come and go. Because candidates, are new figures, so the party label serves as a cue. When you take that cue away, the voter has to rely on something else. That something else tends to be name recognition. Now, the easiest way to get name recognition is to spend money on advertising. And as a result, those people who can spend more money in campaigns are distinctly advantaged. There are other people who are distinctly advantaged, too. But you can get free name recognition by being a demagogue, by being a hate monger. You can just debase politics. And nonpartisan elections also advantage those people.
God knows we have plenty of those around in New York City.
Right. Some of whom have money and some of whom don't. But you certainly can be very successful that way. The third thing that voters rely on, the other thing that voters rely on besides name recognition, is that they look for another cue. If party isn't on the ballot to give the voter a cue, then you look at the candidate's name and you may get a racial or an ethnic cue. Because that will say to you, well, this is someone who shares my views or someone who doesn't share my views. So whereas political parties traditionally have tried to build coalitions to form majorities and have tended to reduce levels of racial and ethnic religious tension, in nonpartisan elections, the strategy is to play up one's race, ethnicity, either appealing to pride or to prejudice. We saw this, for example, in the Los Angeles nonpartisan election for mayor last year, or 2 years ago, where over the last week or so of the campaign, there was a flurry of ads about the losing candidate, Villaraigosa, suggesting connecting a Latino candidate with drug dealers, appealing to the worst instincts of the voters. You see a lot of that happening in nonpartisan politics. It's not good for the body politic.
Now, you're in New York City used to be a virtual one-party state, complete dominance by the Democratic machine. And now we've had a two-term Republican mayor followed by another Republican mayor. What's the status of the party system in New York City right now? Is it really in flux?
Well, what's interesting is that while we've had 10 years of Republican mayors, the Republican Party has made no effort to organize at a local basis. As a result, the Republicans have not run candidates for many city council seats. They didn't run a candidate for controller last time. They didn't run a candidate for public advocate. Now, you can't blame the electoral system for the failure of a political party to organize. The fact of the matter is that there has been so much immigration in New York City and so much out-migration, too, such population turnover. So many of the people who have moved to New York did not come here thinking of themselves as Democrats. And there is no good reason for them, in many ways, no good reason at all for them to vote for the Democratic Party, except that the Democratic Party made some minimal effort to reach out to them. There is no evidence of any effort by the Republican Party to organize, any serious effort to organize immigrant voters in New York. You just have to look at Queens, kind of classic example of this. Or to organize the people who came to New York as Republicans from Indiana or wherever else in the United States to find their fame and fortune in New York City. This isn't a one-party nation by any means. Indeed, one of the things that's most interesting to me is that you've not seen, well, you may have seen more effort by groups like the Independence Party and Working Families Party to organize voters than you have by the Republican Party in New York.
Does that have anything to do with the fact that our Republicans are pretty at odds with the National Republican Party?
No, I think it really has to do with simply a lack of interest in contesting elections. They're interested in the mayoralty. They're interested in the big job. But they appear not to be interested in the others. Now, there are consequences to this kind of politics. I mean, when you have a normal system of parties, there's an electoral connection between the mayor and the other elected officials. They ran together on a ticket. They were elected together. They have a certain common fate. One important thing is that in a system of political parties, the voters can tell who's in charge and who's responsible for what happens. The voters can hold elected officials collectively accountable. In a nonpartisan system, the voters have to investigate each individual politician to find out how that person voted, rather than to say, it's the Democrats' fault or the Democrats have done well. It makes it much harder to hold people accountable. This opens the door to a much more massive use of patronage, campaign contributions, to pluck off one person at a time, because voters have a hell of a time finding out who's representing them on the city council and what that person is doing. It means that in order for the mayor to move a legislative package, when the mayor doesn't have a partisan connection to the council, the mayor has to use much more patronage to move individual votes. It's much harder to have the kind of clean and open government that one should want in a democratic political system.
Okay, and just get to mechanics. Where is this proposal right now, and where does it have to go?
Well, the Charter Revision Commission is about to vote to accept the proposal. The anticipation is that it will be placed on the ballot in November's election, and people will vote for it as a single question, up or down. Are you for it or against it? And that's where it goes. If it's this November, there'll be a very fast campaign. Don't know how many people are paying attention. It's going to be a difficult job to educate the public.
Well, we're hoping you'll help.
Well, thank you.
And since you're here, let me change the topic rather dramatically. We've got a couple of minutes remaining. Another area of your expertise is gay politics in the United States. And after the Supreme Court sodomy decision, there was a Gallup poll that showed a sizable shift of opinion away from tolerance and towards more negative attitudes after many, many years of increasing tolerance and acceptance of gay life. Is this just an anomaly, or do you think there's some serious backlash gathering?
Too early to tell. At the same time that there was that Gallup poll, there also was a Pew Trusts poll that showed increasing acceptance. And today is a CBS New York Times poll that shows no change. So it could be an artifact of Gallup's sampling frame, questionnaire design. It's really hard to tell. At this point, I think that people have overreacted to an anomaly. It wouldn't be unusual for there to be a little backlash. I mean, especially with the Canadian marriage decision at the same time and the forthcoming marriage cases in New Jersey and in Massachusetts. I mean, after all, it was 10 years between Brown versus Board of Education and the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And the Civil Rights Act of 64 was done legislatively. It wasn't done by the judiciary. Conservatives traditionally have a very hard time with the pace of change. And to have two major breaks in a very short period of time probably will shake some people up. I don't think anybody scheduled this to happen this way, but this is the way things are happening. It's really too early to tell, I mean, about backlash, because, you know, what the polls also show consistently is that over the past decade, the percent of Americans who say that they have a good friend or a relative who is lesbian or gay has doubled. A majority of Americans now have a close friend or relative who's lesbian or gay. And it's one thing to have some kind of unknown boogeyman out there, and it's another thing to be talking about a member of your family. So, I mean, you know, even Bush has been fairly restrained. I mean, yesterday he sort of said, "Who's going to cast the first stone?" Although he used a rather different phrase, I think, about, you know, we're all sinners, but, you know, it's still the same kind of line. I think, you know, the fact that Cheney has an openly lesbian daughter is going to play in some fashion to what this government's going to do. But I may be unduly optimistic on it. It's not as bad as Gallup makes it seem.
Oh. All right, thanks for the reassurance. And thanks for joining us, Ken Sherrill. And we know you have to get out of here, so
thank you.
Thanks for coming by. And Ken Sherrill teaches politics at Hunter College, and we'll be back with Helen Rudy Brockman after this word from Paul Van Dyke. And Behind the News is transforming itself into a dance club. That was Paul Van Dyke, a little bit of excerpt from his Ministry of Sound mix from a few years ago. And now we're joined on the line by Helen Rudy Brockman, who is a nurse at NYU and also active with the Physicians for a National Health Program, who is here to clarify what's going on with the Medicare prescription drug benefit proposals. Welcome to WBAI.
Thank you.
So, and this is your radio premiere, I think, so we're just having a friendly phone conversation.
Okay.
All right. It sounds good on the surface. The Congress and the President are trying to get some kind of prescription drug benefit inserted into Medicare, but there are a lot of devils hiding in the details. So what's on the table to start with?
Okay. Well, what's on the table is two different plans, one in the House and one in the Senate. And I won't go into the details because getting to the devil is, with limited time, what we need to address. Because the biggest problem is that they rely on private insurance companies to provide the coverage. And since those kinds of standalone prescription insurance plans don't exist now, then there's probably a reason. And whether or not that is feasible is a very big question.
Why would they not exist in the private sector?
Because they're not, I would imagine, because they're not profitable, because the cost of prescriptions is very high. And, for example, in terms of what kind of funding has been allocated, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that over the next 10 years, $1.84 trillion will be spent on prescription drugs, whereas the amount that has been allocated is like $375 billion. In fact, one of the senators, Grassley from Iowa, is quoted in an article in the LA Times as saying that there are no real resources in it. So the piece of paper has flaws to begin with, but if there's no money behind it, then it doesn't become a reality for Medicare recipients.
Now, a lot of people are also seeing in this proposal an attempt to do a little creeping privatization of Medicare. How's that work?
Well, the House version does that, and the House version has in it language that would eventually make Medicare competitive with the private plans, and so it could crowd out, also there are, I'm sorry, that one I have to get back to you on, but it does, the Senate version does not have that problem. So so that would be the preferred of the two, but it's still far from perfect.
Well, you know, of course, bringing in the private sector, everyone says that'll promote efficiency because governments are inefficient. That's not really true of at least health insurance. Could you give us a comparison of how the private sector versus Medicare handles these things?
Well, for example, the average administrative cost for a private health plan is 9.5%, although the administrative costs for some health plans go as high as almost 20%. The administrative cost for Medicare is 1.1%. So certainly, you know, people think that the government, doesn't do it very efficiently, but in talking to people who are in the business world, they say that, in general, administrative costs should never be above 5. So at 9.5, you're already twice what is recommended in the business world.
And also, there are proposals to slip some means testing into Medicare for the first time ever.
Yes.
What's going on with that?
Well, that is all very confusing, which is one of the problems, because the wonderful thing about Medicare is that as a provider, the wonderful thing is that it's straightforward, that the recipient knows what it covers, more or less. The providers know what it covers, and you just submit a bill, and it's very straightforward. However, when there's all of this information you have to submit as to how much you've spent, and it's referred to as the donut among some circles, because depending upon the House or the Senate version, for example, under the Senate plan, coverage phases out after $4,500 and picks up again at $5,800. In the House bill, coverage phases out at 2,000 and returns at 4,900. Now, who is keeping track of when you get to 4,500 and when you get to 5,800? What if you have prescriptions in Florida and in New York? How is all of that going to be accomplished? And you have people who are on chronic therapy, and in the middle of the therapy, their coverage disappears. So the medical consequences are very, very severe.
Well, how big a burden is the cost of prescription drugs for seniors?
Well, one example, I spoke to one of my colleagues who is a geriatrician, and she said that, for example, if someone is admitted to the hospital for their heart attack, and we now have wonderful medications and procedures and so on that can help people to survive. However, they're discharged home on probably 5 new medications that they will need to take in order to maintain their health and prevent another heart attack. So the cost is also determined by whether or not it's brand or generic. And so that's a long and complicated story, but the other thing that this relates to is that in these provisions that are currently in Congress, there is no restriction on what would be charged. So ideally, the benefit of having a big pool of people is that if it was the government could negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, as countries that have universal health care do, to get a better price, then we would be able to provide more people with the medications. But currently, it's the provider's market.
Let me make sure I'm clear on that. There's no attempt to do any kind of cost control. Would this be a blank check for the pharmaceutical industry?
That's one way of seeing it. Because, for example, in the House bill, there is no provision that there needs to be any competition. In the Senate bill, it provides that if there is only one company providing coverage in a given area, then the federal government will provide government-sponsored coverage, maybe buying into the federal insurance plan. But, if there's, in the House version, only one company, they can charge whatever they want. And in rural America, what is the likelihood that one is going to have a lot of choice between companies? And the choice word is one that I think is very important, because people feel that if the government is doing it, that they won't have choice. But now, even as a provider, we don't have choice as to what drug we can prescribe, because each of the managed care plans has their own formulary with the deals that they make with the pharmaceutical companies for which drug is preferred. So if you write for a prescription for a medication that is not preferred, then the patient will either have to pay a very large copay or not have it covered at all.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. The show is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and you can also hear us on the web at WBAI.org. And also, everyone should check out that website, your web voice for peace and justice, as this radio station is your radio voice for peace and justice. The website now a very active and lively and informative place. So if you haven't checked it, please do. I'm speaking with Helen Rudy Brockman, who is a nurse at NYU and also a active within Physicians for a National Health Program. The mentioned earlier means testing in some of these proposals.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get back to that issue. First of all, there's also an attempt to blur the lines between Medicare and Medicaid and shift some Medicare people into Medicaid. What's that about?
Well, actually, I mean, that happens somewhat now, because when the Medicare recipient has so little resources that they can't afford to buy their medications, and sometimes they become eligible for Medicaid. But one of the things about means testing is that, for example, if you have property, so if you have an elderly person who owns their house, then that is considered an asset. So in order to be eligible for some of these plans, it could mean that someone who owns their home would not be eligible, because their home would be an asset that they would have to liquidate before they would be eligible.
And You are with Physicians for a National Health Program, and you know, it seemed for a while that healthcare was kind of dead as a political issue. Is it coming back to life?
Well, it certainly is back to life in terms of the Democratic candidates are talking about. Some of them are talking about universal health care. And I think that the most important thing is that people are beginning to realize, we in the healthcare community have known for a long time that the system is broken. And this is like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound, these kinds of proposals. And so I think that people are beginning to see that there are major flaws in the current system and that there needs to be a way to address it. And as the only industrialized country in the world that does not cover all of its residents, we certainly have a ways to go. And the other thing I think that people have been unaware of and is now getting more publicity is that it's perceived that ours is the best system, the highest quality. But actually, the World Health Organization rates us as 37th.
That's pretty far down the list.
Yeah.
And why do we rate so poorly? I mean, if you've got lots of money, you can certainly get some fancy medicine.
Well, some people can get fancy medicine and fancy procedures, but the criteria that is used to evaluate a healthcare system are factors like infant mortality, life expectancy, and so we rank below, I believe it's Cuba, in terms of infant mortality. Our life expectancy is lower because you then have to average in the rest of the population that doesn't have access to these services. In populations of color, there are glaring statistics that indicate that not only do they not have access to the care, but when they get the care, it is not of the same quality. And so you have to average in the fact that there are major portions of the population that are not having access to that great American care.
Well, you spend much of your day taking care of actual patients. What has this ongoing crisis in healthcare finance, how has that changed the way you do your work?
It has made what is supposed to be the job is to work with the patient with regard to their health. That part has become the easy part. The hard part is trying to negotiate the system. What insurance do they have? You know, does their insurance cover this? Will their insurance, will the specialist you want to refer them to take their insurance? You know, spending time on the phone, getting permission from, for example, with the pharmaceuticals, getting permission from the private insurance companies to give the patient the medication that you feel is the most appropriate. And the other concern from a clinical point of view, again, referring to my colleague Roseanne Leipzig, who is at Mount Sinai and a geriatrician of national regard, is that in the elderly, there is the potential for many, many drug interactions. And you have to really very carefully determine what drugs go together and which ones can't. And so if you have a system where, depending upon what your coverage is, you have this drug this week and another drug next month because your coverage changed, then that could really seriously affect the health of the person taking the medication.
The people in the healthcare professions used to be fairly opposed to any kind of government meddling with healthcare finance. Of course, the AMA most notoriously was against socialized medicine for decades. Are opinions changing in the healthcare professions?
Indeed. There is a movement among physicians to identify that things need to be changed. And the other thing when you talk about financing is that I've been in healthcare for over 20 years, and years ago, you know, Medicaid was something that people were not real inclined to take. Medicare, they felt that they should, but it still wasn't a great payer. Now, the government plans are what people are more than happy to take because it's clear, it's straightforward, they pay on time, and even though they don't pay enough or as much as they could, it's still easier and better on what you can collect than dealing with the private plans that you often have to submit and resubmit. And so, you know, one has to remember that the motive of a private company is profit. And so, you know, when you talk about the government running things and people don't want the government telling them what to do, but at the same time, if you have for-profit companies running things, then they tell you what to do, and for the motivation of saving money so that they can make profit. So the underlying premise just doesn't hold water.
Yeah, that was one of the arguments against socialized medicine for all those years, was that the government would dictate procedures and of care. And now we're seeing the private sector doing that far more intrusively than any public system ever would. Just talk about what it's like to have these sort of accountants over your shoulders as you're doing your work.
The documentation, the amount of, you know, it gets back to the administrative costs. You know, the administrative costs for Medicare are 1.1%. The administrative costs for private insurance are average 9.5%. So, you know, we have to spend time doing all of those administrative tasks rather than doing the clinical work. And so it makes the practice difficult because you have to see more patients in order to make the money, to be able to exist. There are many, many people who are in primary care who are shutting down their practices because they cannot make ends meet. And they feel that they have a professional responsibility to practice in a safe way, but in order to do that, you can't keep your head above water with what the financing is. And so many, many physicians and healthcare professionals are deciding that something has to be done. Now, the term socialized medicine is another interesting term. The main issue is that the money is not being well divided, that there is a lot of money in some pots and no money in other pots. And what people don't understand is that the government already pays for the sickest patients and pays more than the private sector does for care under the current system. And so if we had all the money in one pot, then we could distribute the resources in a more reasonable way. And this gets back to the situation with these private plans doing the prescription coverage. What happened with Medicare was that in order to get prescription coverage, many Medicare recipients got into HMOs so that they could get the prescriptions. Well, the healthiest ones were the ones who went in, and then when they got too sick and too expensive, they have been removed. So, you know, there is this cherry-picking concept that, again, gets back to the basis of a profit-making private corporation, is that you want the healthiest people who cost the least money, and then the sick ones are a liability.
You're sick, we can't treat you. That's quite a system.
We can't cover you.
Yeah.
And so there are people who have been, not allowed to renew. I've had patients who were not allowed to renew because, that wasn't what was said, but the reality is that, you know, many people were no longer able to get the pharmaceutical coverage because they were the expensive sector of society. So the other thing as a nurse practitioner is that our focus is on, you know, management of chronic conditions, prevention, education, counseling. And in a system where the bottom line for that quarter or that year is what matters, then it is not a good investment for private insurance companies to invest in preventive care. In fact, many of them don't cover preventive care. Because if today my company spends money on teaching you something that will save spending money 20 years down the road, if you are no longer with my company 20 years down the road, then my company has only lost money and never gained in the long run. So they have no incentive to invest in prevention, which is what's the most cost effective.
All right, so enough of the grim news. What first of all, what's Physicians for a National Health Program up to these days, and what might the listeners do to get
involved? All right, well, this is the what to do. There are our websites. I don't know if you're going to be giving them, that you can contact to find out about what's going on. People don't realize how important contacting members of Congress is. Your statements are definitely heard. People feel very, very ineffective and like they have no voice, but they really can. And Physicians for a National Health Program has legislation in Congress that would provide for universal health care with all the money in one pot. And there is a petition that physicians around the country are signing. So there are a lot of activities all over the country trying to increase awareness of this issue and also to try to address it in a way that is going to work, because we've already tried having Medicare recipients involved in private insurance plans, and it didn't work. We already know that. So this is not the approach to go. The only benefit of the Senate bill is that it does recognize Medicare as the entity it is and does not seek to try to undermine it as the House bill does.
All right, and you mentioned some websites. First of all, is it PNHP.org, Physicians for National
Health? It is. PNHP.org is the national. And then there is also Families USA is an organization that's working for universal health care. And then there is the Medicare rights organization. So Medicare rights, since that's what we're talking about, is www.medicarerights.org. PNHP is www.pnhp.org. There is a New York City chapter, of which I'm on the board, and that is www.nyc. It's on my email list. I have to think about that one. I'll get it. And the one for Families USA is Health Action is their newsletter, or www.familiesusa.org. And the local chapter is www.pnhpnyc.org.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us. I'll repeat those in a little bit. Thank you for joining us, Helen Rudy Brockman, who is a nurse practitioner at NYU and also active within Physicians for a National Health Program. And I'll be back after this word from Paul Van Dyke. Club music continues. More from Paul Van Dyke's Ministry of Sound Mix from several years ago. And the program is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwick, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. And I normally do some news and commentary at the top of the show, but we had a guest at the beginning who had to get out early, so I'm postponing my own bit of narcissism until late in the show. And let's so. a couple of things to look at. First of all, how about that Poindexter terrorism futures plan? Now canceled, of course, and looks like Poindexter reminds me of the Iran-Contra days. Some wit pointed out that how could you expect any good to come of a government in which Ali and Poindexter were prominent figures? Cheap jokes at somebody's name, of course, is beneath me. But the idea of trading futures on terrorism is utterly preposterous. But the underlying thinking behind that, which some of our finest economists embraced with enthusiasm, and it was embraced by Hal Varian, a Berkeley economist in today's New York Times, is that markets are wiser than institutions like governments can ever possibly be. And so that's the idea. We can't expect analysts to read papers and do their spying and do those things that CIA analysts are supposed to do. No, what we need to do is collect a bunch of speculators together who will buy and sell futures based on their perceptions of things. And this is based on a whole lot of theory in economics that that markets are immensely wise and all-knowing and almost godly in their wisdom. It makes you wonder about that wisdom, though. Remember the globe.com, which was one of the stars of the dot-com era back several years ago. The globe.com at its peak in early 1999 was trading for $133 a share. A couple of months ago, it was trading at 16 cents a share. So I'm wondering, at what moment was this wise market telling the truth, at $133 a share or 16 cents a share? How about the oil market, which has been, price of oil has been as low as $10 a barrel and as high as $40 a barrel in the last 15 years. Which was the right price? Was either the right price? Could the market ever make any allowance for ecological crisis or running out of oil or any of those longer-term concerns? No, of course not. Market prices are based on very, very short-term judgments about what might happen tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, but certainly not anything that's going to happen weeks, months, years from now. So this faith in the wisdom of the market is extremely widely held in the economics profession and among pundits, but really needs a dire need of a serious rethink. Anyway, the burning question at the moment in the economic beat is the U.S. economy recovering? Consensus emerging over the last month or two is that, yes, it is. There are almost universal expectations that we're making transition from a stabilization phase in the economy to an acceleration that's occurring in the second half of this year. There's some evidence that this isn't a total crock, but there's also a lot of wishful thinking involved. Let's look at some of the evidence. First, a little bit of historical background. I mentioned the great internet bubble of a little while ago, and that is part of the background. We had an incredible economic boom, financial speculative mania in the late 1990s, the era of easy finance and massive overinvestment. And with it came a deep psychology of deep complacency and arrogance that you know, Americans thought they had solved the economic problem forever and that our economic model was the envy of the world. Well, all that burst in 2000, the year 2000, the stock market leading the way and then the real economy a bit later. According to the official arbiters of these sorts of things, the National Bureau of Economic Research's Business Cycle Dating Committee, we had a recession that began in March 2001 and that ended in November 2001, a very short recession and a very mild one by official measures. And before I continue, some people occasionally ask what a recession is, and worth defining. It's a broad and extended period of decline in employment, production, and incomes. It's not, as sometimes people say, two consecutive quarters of decline in gross domestic product. That's an informal definition, but the formal definition, the official definition, is that it's a broad decline across an economy in employment, production, and incomes. And we saw that in 2001. But the conventional business cycle has a recession phase, but then it also has a recovery and expansion phase as well. The recovery is when the ground lost in the recession is recovered, as the name suggests, and the expansion is when you start hitting new highs in income, employment, and production. And even though we had a recession that ended in November 2001 by official measures, the recovery has been very, very weak, and the expansion has been virtually non-existent. The U.S. economy has lost 938,000 jobs since the recession officially ended. That's not supposed to happen after recessions are over. We're supposed to have expansion, not further decline. We've lost almost 400,000 jobs since the beginning of this year. This is very, very unusual behavior. We've never had five consecutive months of employment decline outside a recession. So that's what we've had earlier this year. We would, if we were in the midst of more normal times, we'd be adding 200,000 jobs a month instead of losing 50 or 75 as we've been losing. Seen job losses in manufacturing for over 3 years, the longest streak in recorded history. And recorded history begins in 1939. So very, very severe damage in the manufacturing sector, and not so severe outside it, but still, we're still losing jobs, which is not supposed to be happening in a recovering economy. But GDP, the broadest measure of all, the ones that the most favorite measure of economists, the total value of goods and services produced in the United States, that's up. Even though employment is down, it's up not very much, about 4% over the last few years. Again, a fraction of what it would be in a normal recovery expansion, but still at least positive. But employment is down by about 1%. A couple of things have been happening there. Growth has been very slow. Most recoveries are quite sharp and strong. But employment is lagging growth very badly. Growth is, so you put these two things together, and that's why you have a very weak job market. Growth is maybe half as strong as it would be in a normal recovery. But on top of that, employment is very slow relative to growth. If we were experiencing the normal relation between economic growth and employment growth, we'd be adding almost 130,000 jobs a month instead of losing them as we have been. So why this strange behavior? Why there's slow growth and there's very weak employment performance? Well, I think it's what happens after the bubble bursts. We had this period of mania, overinvestment, overspeculation, and a lot of people were wounded in those expectations. And so overinvestment means that, and ensuing caution means that businesses have been very, very slow to expand and to hire, and we haven't shaken that off yet. But that's history, and what about now? There are a spate of reports in recent weeks showing some gathering strength in the U.S. economy. It's an organization called the Chicago Purchasing Managers, which polls the purchasing managers for corporations, the people who buy stuff. Released this morning showed a positive number, far above expectations. And this morning's release on fresh claims for unemployment insurance, that number was down by about 3,000 and is now well below the 400,000 mark thought of as recessionary. Now, there are some problems with this number. There's been some retooling of auto plants as models changed over, but that may be clouding the numbers. But should this trend hold up over the coming weeks, that would be a good sign for at least some reversal in the state of the job market. And also this morning, we had a release of gross domestic product, the first report for the second quarter, and it was up a lot more than expected. Most people were expecting a 1 to 1.5% increase, and instead it was about 2.4%, far greater than anyone expected. And it was led, that expansion was led by so-called defense procurement, up 44% at an annual rate. Very, 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 very remarkable. The strongest quarterly growth since the beginning of the Korean War in the war business. But also there was expansion in consumer demand for durable goods, particularly autos. And finally, some signs that businesses are beginning to invest. There was an increase in capital spending, that is money businesses spend on equipment and software. That contraction in business expenditures was what led the recession down in 2001 and has been very, very, very slow to recover. It's been shrinking in recent years. But at least some sign of a turnaround there. So very weak by historical standards, but at least a step in the right direction. So we've seen very substantial easing by the Federal Reserve. They push interest rates down very, very dramatically over the last few years. That has lent some stimulus to the economy. Now, of course, we're also getting the $400 tax rebate checks to all families with children beginning to arrive in the mail. So this could boost the economy for the next several quarters. This is politically interesting because election perceptions are generally formed the spring before the election. If the economy is looking better come next spring, then that may be all W needs to be reelected, assuming that other things don't turn against him. This would be just the opposite of his father's experience. The economy looked bad in the spring of 1992, even though it was beginning to recover, and Daddy Bush lost the election. Maybe things will look good next spring for President 43, and he will have his reelection. But I still think that we're in a period of longer-term economic troubles. We can have an upwave within a period of broader stagnation or trouble, and that I think is what's going on right now. But none of this is following the textbooks in any ways. So we'll have to keep on this on top of this in the coming weeks and months. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with another word from Paul Van Dyke.